Tata and opening the sutra.
The Dharma, incomparably profound and infinitely subtle, is rarely encountered, even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning.
This is case number 27 of the Mumen Khan. Nonsense, not mind, not Buddha, not things, or sometimes it's translated as not beings. The case. A monk asks Nansen in all earnestness, is there any Dharma that hasn't been preached to the people? And Nansen says, there is. The monk said, what is the Dharma which has never been preached to the people? Nansen said, it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not things or beings. So there's, we have people here may not know what Dharma is, but that's in one sense the insights of Buddhism. The insights we'll do for this occasion. And so he's asking, is there anyone, any of those insights that hasn't been preached to the people? Like, is there something you're holding back? Are there some secret stuff? I don't have my decoder ring, and I can't figure that out. And Shimayama, who's another person who translates the Mumen Khan, said, is there any Dharma that has not yet been preached to people? And that sort of reinforces the idea there might be some hidden thing or esoteric thing that Zen's got to. That's not really what's at issue for me here today. And Nansen is one of the more famous of the Zen teachers. He appears, there are three big koan books, and he appears in all of them a bunch of times. So he's one of the most widely represented Zen teachers in this whole way of teaching Zen, the Soto, not the Soto, but the Rinzai way. And he was the Dharma transmitter to Chaocho, or Joshu, who is sort of the favorite around here. We all like Joshu. And this same question was once asked, Nansen once asked to his teacher, Hakujo Nihon. So it's a go around, what goes around comes around version of it. And there's a longer version of this koan in another one of the koan books, which goes on and has other wrinkles in it. But Mumen, who's the guy who arranged this, shortened it because he just wanted this one short teaching. It's a very short koan. Is there any hidden stuff? There's no Buddha, there's no mind, there's no beings, no things. And it's also reminiscent of something the Buddha said, which is very weird if you're thinking in traditional terms about any religious teacher. Buddha gave, by some accounts, over 300 public talks or sermons or lectures or whatever. And then at one point he says, in my 49 years of teaching, I did not preach even one word. So this is why people don't practice Zen very often. It's like, okay, what a minute. I devoted my life to you. You haven't preached a single word. Come on. And what could he possibly mean by that? And I guess one way of thinking it, if you're thinking in theological terms, is I can't tell you what God is. If you want to have a definition of God, don't come here. I'm not the person to let you know about that. But on the face of it, what do we make of a religion that only offers its communicants, offers them no clear help at discerning the central issues? it's always, the help is always oblique. Like, uh-huh. That's the best you get is uh-huh out of the whole thing. So, you know, the great matters are in Zen, the matter of our identity, the true nature of life and death, the meaning of existence, all those big things that kids talk about when they're adolescents and in dorm rooms and in colleges and other places. And it appears that in this koan, with very little provocation, Nansen throws out everything, including Buddha, and all the key terms. Mind is a key term in Zen, although it doesn't mean just, you know, what's between your ears. And if he doesn't throw them out to the trash, at least he throws them out to the recycling. So Zen asks us to, if you initiate, you know, if you become a formal teacher, you want to devote yourself to meditation and study the words of the Buddhas and his followers, and then you take a bunch of impossible vows, and then you follow various grave precepts, and there's lots of numbers to all of these things. And if you're a monk back in nonsense time, you have to give up all your worldly possessions. In fact, this is true in some Zen centers now. You have to give up everything. And in Japan, they had to go out and beg in the mornings. And so it wasn't a cushy deal. And in the end, it seems that Nansen is saying, out of it all, you get nothing. And Nansen is the guy who, after all, and there's one of the most famous koans called Nansen Kills a Cat. The monks on the two wings of the Zen center are fighting about a cat. And Nansen comes in and says, can anybody say anything to save this cat? And everyone sits around dumbfounded. And Nansen kills the cat because nobody could say anything for it. Whether we think he literally killed them or not. But Nansen is the guy who takes the cat that you thought was yours, that you were claiming on your end, and he kills it. So this is a guy who is, Peter used the term thief last week, a Zen teacher is a thief. He takes away stuff until all that's left is us. Then what is us? So, sometimes this question has been asked, you know, is there any hidden teaching? And a master, Bukai, who was asked that question, said, what's under your feet? Is there any hidden stuff? What's under your feet? I suppose this implies that the Dharma is everywhere. And everything that's out in the open is, quote unquote, the hidden teacher. It's hidden in plain sight. So the root of this koan is the root of so many other koans where the monk asks for an answer as if he didn't contain the answer himself, or herself in modern times. The answers are in us, but they're not speakable. We have to live them primarily as questions. And the only way we can speak them is in terms of metaphor. And come back to what Peter was saying before, in terms of what it's not, in terms of negation. This is actually something that's in Christianity, in mystical Christianity. It's called the via negativa, the negative way of arriving at what God is. First you take away all the stuff, and then what are you left with? And that's what's behind saying no Buddha. In Buddha, there, when Peter was talking about, I came in the middle of it, I'm not sure exactly what he said, but, you know, when you bow to the Buddha, you're not bowing to some superior being. It's a person who worked hard to have a particular kind of realization. And you think, okay, I'm impressed by what he did. I think that that's a worthy goal, and that's what I'm focused on. In the same way that, you know, when you're parenting, you're supposed to say, when your kid does something awful, you don't say, you're awful. You say, what you did was awful. So if you turn that positively, you know, we don't, it's not what Buddha did, it's what Buddha realized. It's a very different thing. I suppose all of this can be summed up in the famous joke, which I'm sure many of you have heard. The monk asks the hot dog dealer, make me one with everything. And that was the joke that I first heard, and then I just heard this wrinkle relatively recently. So the monk hands the vendor the money, and he gets the hot dog back in return, but he doesn't get his change. And he says, hey, what about my change? And the vendor says, change comes from within. So that's what Zen teachers are. They're cruel bastards. Change comes from within. Oh, great. Can I take that to the bank? No, you actually can't take that to the bank. And that's the point. Jim is here, and so I have to say something from Dylan. Dylan asked in one of his songs, there must be some way out of here, said the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. And what's the answer to that? Change comes from within. The only way out is through. The only way out of difficulty is to be the difficulty, to utterly embrace it, not to turn sideways to it. We were talking about in one of the Daisan today, we were talking about that. So there's pain, and then there's suffering. You can make this distinction. Again, this is just letting out words. But pain is what comes with being alive. You know, your boyfriend leaves you. Your mother or your father dies. Pain is inevitable. We're going to die. Suffering is a different thing because there's an element of election to it. Suffering is when we hold on to it. So Margaret always told the story, which I have told, it's not even a story, it's just an anecdote. So when Dalai Lama, someone from Tibet who's escaped from Tibet comes to the Dalai Lama and says, here's what happened. You know, I had to leave my brothers and sisters behind, my uncle died on the way over, and other people got frostbite. And his, when he tell him this, his face crumbles just like a little baby's. Just like a little baby's. When they're about to dissolve to tears. Crumbles. He's absolutely the pain that you have just expressed. And then, back out. Back out of it. Because he can experience it completely, then he can also let go of it. But the person who said it knows that he has experienced it right down to his very shoes, the core of his being. So, in the teaching, the student comes and looks for an answer, and the teacher does not give that answer, and what the student must do is look for what's implicit in that. And often enough, it's, you know, change comes from within. There are no answers from the outside. This may seem, I think, to conflict a bit with a higher power in the 12 steps, but you can think of that higher power as the beyond that's within us. That part of us which is unspeakably profound that we're actually born with. And whether we give it a particular name, such as the higher power or not, is less important than experiencing that part of us which is undefinable, unspeakable, which is already profoundly okay and actually has the wisdom that we need. And so I'm going to give you, as I often do, a poem. And this one's by, well...
don't have enough because I didn't know that we were going to have Philly Yankee Stadium today. You two are, yeah. You two are in luck. I even got an extra here, so. So, finding a teacher, and I went to print this off, and the name did not print. It's one of those things that was in blue, and my computer didn't recognize it. So, I could just keep you in the dark by that. You know, you could say, oh, master, who's the author of the poem? Not Buddha. Not even W.S. Merwin, who wrote it. So W.S. Merwin used to sit with Steph and Margaret in New York City for years. He sat with them, and then he moved out to Hawaii, where he found a teacher that he was completely compatible with, Aiken Roshi, is a very great teacher, and wrote one of the books that Peter and I love, especially.
Mind of Clover.
Mind of Clover. It is a great book where it talks about, it's very unconventional. So one of the things you say in Buddhism is, I vow to take up the way of not stealing. And so in one way, that's pretty simple. I'm not going to rip off, Gertrude's lipstick, because even though it's sitting in the front seat of the car. But how broadly can you take that? You can steal your own time. You can steal time from other people. I take it the way I'm not seeing it. How broadly can you see it? And he's constantly taking these things that are pretty closely related to the Ten Commandments and opening them up in a metaphorical way that allows us to see them freshly. Anyway, he's great. So this is a sort of parable of his finding Aiken. In the woods, I came on an old friend fishing, and I asked him a question, and he said, wait. Fish were rising in the deep stream, but his line was not stirring. But I waited. It was a question about the sun, about my two eyes, my ears, my mouth, my heart, the earth with its four seasons, my feet, where I was standing, where I was going. It slipped through my hands as though it were water into the river. It flowed under the trees. It sank under the hulls far away and was gone without me. Then, where I stood, night fell. I no longer knew what to ask. I could tell that his line had no hook. I understood that I was to stay and eat with him. So he's a guy who's got a lot of questions about the things that we should be asking, these really big questions. And I come up to, I, and he comes up to his friend, and his friend says, wait, friend's fishing. Wait, just wait. Doesn't give him any answer. He goes on fishing. And finally, at the end of it all, he realizes that this guy has been fishing without a hook. He's not fishing to gain something. He's not fishing. He's just deeply immersed in his experience. He doesn't have to get anything out of it. So much of what we do, we're hoping for a gain. And when we come and sit here, we're hoping for a gain. I want to get calmer. I want to find out who I am underneath all of the bullshit. Or as Whitman says, underneath all the pulling and hauling, who am I? He also says somewhere else, I play the part that looks back on the actor and the actress. So I play a part which is my original nature, not the stuff that I learned to play. We all learn. So finding a teacher, the fish were rising deep in the stream, but his line was not stirring.
I waited. It was a question, the question, I asked him a question. It was a question about the sun, about my two eyes, you know. It was a question about everything. My ear, what is the nature of my two eyes? What is this miracle of my sight, my taste, my five senses, my heart? What's the nature of this creation? And what is it that I'm standing on? We forget that we're ensconced in a deep and absolutely spectacular mystery all the time, every single instant. We forget that it's a miracle. We forget that the fact that anything exists is a stupendous, spectacular thing. And he's got all these questions, and he wants to know about the nature of all of those questions. So he's got that radical wonder. He's got those questions, as Rilke, the poet, says, forget about the answers, live the questions. But even as he's hanging on to these questions, they're slipping away, because everything slips away. How long can you say to yourself, okay, I want to ask him about the sun. I want to ask him about the sun. I want to ask him. Well, a few hours go by, you forget that. It's gone. You know? And all of those questions are slipping away, both because we can't hold on to anything for very long, and because ultimately the teacher is waiting until the questions stop. It slipped through my hands as though it were water, and it slipped into the river. All the questions became part of the river, part of the flow, part of this very moment. What's the nature of this very moment? We don't know. So one of the things that Zen is interested in cultivating is the fact that we don't know. I saw a wonderful video, which I'd recommend to you, about W.S. Murray when he moved to Hawaii, and then he started gathering palms that were environmentally threatened. So he's growing over 200 palm trees, some of which don't exist anywhere else but on his land. And they show him, he's in his 80s, but he's still out there doing his gardening. And he's watching him make some stuff up in his pot. Then he looks up at the camera and says, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing. So this is a guy who's really wise, has gone through all kinds of transformations in his life, and really thought he knew what he was doing for a long time. And I think he made a few wives pay for that. until he finally gave up his shenanigans. And he's so at home that he doesn't know. He's just doing it. I no longer knew what to ask. I could tell that his line, this is the big discovery, I could tell that his line had no hook. No hook. I taught this in a class once, and there were a couple of guys in the class who thought this was the funniest thing that they ever heard, fishing without a hook. And they just made it a shtick for the rest of the semester, fishing without a hook. They just made it, and it was a wonderful metaphor for what they, for what. We hope to gain stuff, but what do we gain in the end? What can we gain? What are we taking with us when we leave this world? Ain't squat. What is there to gain? What are the answers? Don't know. I no longer knew what to ask. I could tell that his line had no hook. I understood that I was to stay and eat with him. And I think that's a funny way of ending. Since the guy has caught no fish, yeah. What are they going to eat? grass or what? So what sustains us in the end? Well, we got to have our food. But what really sustains us? What sustains us? Where is the bubbling spring? Change comes from within. So, as is the custom with Zen talks, you end by repeating it. A monk asked Nansen in all earnestness, is there any Dharma that hasn't been preached to the people? Nansen said, there is.
the monk. He said, oh, wow, now I'm going to get the skinny. The monk said, what is the Dharma which has never been preached to the people? Nansen said, it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not things, it's not people. So, and I love what Mumon's commentary is. Nansen was merely asked a question, and he exhausted all of his positions at once and was reduced to nothing. Nansen just obliterated himself. And then he goes on to say, speaking too much degrades virtue. No words are truly effective. Even though the great ocean should change, it can never be communicated to you. So there's something we don't know. And even the words that I have said now, even if they were way, way better than they are, would not be enough to touch that thing that we just don't know. Thank you.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.
So much pull in the skin.
Right.